Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820, brings you Family Sanctuary, a show that inspires living the gospel message in word and deed within our families. And now, Family Sanctuary, with hosts Mary Ann Jepson and Peggy Hartshorn.
Welcome to the Family Sanctuary on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820, and online at stgabrielradio.com. I'm Mary Ann Jepson, your host. It's great to have you with me today. On today's show, we're going to hear one man's dramatic story of his steady decline into the dark world of drug addiction, his numerous attempts at rehabilitation in secular centers, and his eventual rise out of the darkness through a community for addicts founded in 1983 by a dynamic Catholic nun in Italy named Mother Elvira Petrazzi. Mother Elvira worked with young men and women who lived in real desperation and hopelessness, and oftentimes they believed that their lives had no meaning or value, so they turned to drugs or other addictions to seek that excitement and fill the voids in their souls. But Mother loved them so much, and she knew that only Christ could really heal their tragic wounds. And so she formed the community that helped change so many lives around the world. There are many, many homes, many communities around the world. The name of the major community is Chinakalo. And my guest today is Philip Szabo, who spent several years at Chinakalo. First, to break away from the lifestyle that was killing him, he spent a number of years there really getting through the addiction and learning a different way of life. But then he spent many years also giving back to the community as a leader. And so it's really, really a great privilege to introduce to you my friend, Philip Szabo. Welcome, Philip.
Good morning, Marianne. Good morning, everyone.
It's so nice to have you with me, Philip.
It's my pleasure.
I mean, it's just been such a blessing for me to be involved in some level with the Chinakalo community and to get to see the real miracles that happen in people's lives there. And oftentimes I think that if you didn't ask their stories, if you didn't know their stories, and most often I don't know the people's stories, but it's just the wonderful people, that's what I see when I visit Chinakalo. And so, Philip, why don't you start us off by really telling us, share your story of what happened with you in your life. You grew up in Vienna, Austria, which is, I would say, it's a that's a pretty beautiful place to grow up.
It is indeed. It's the most beautiful city in the world. Of course, I can say that since I'm from there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really make good use of it. I think I grew up in wonderful surroundings, a beautiful city with a beautiful family. It just didn't work out for me. I had to come to community to realize how lucky I was. I grew up in Vienna, and I come from a loving family. And even though we weren't like the Catholic example, we would still say grace and say prayers before we went to bed when I was a little child. But then through the years into my family, my mom and my dad had big differences, and the prayers somewhat got lost. We strayed away from God, and so it happened when I was 5 years old that my parents got divorced. And I went with my sister, with my older sister, she's 4 years older, and my mom, and we left, and both my mom and dad got remarried after a short while, so I was living with my mom and my now new stepdad, and it was very hard for me to understand and accept that. My parents, my mom told me later on, they waited till I was of a certain age to understand, but honestly, 5 years wasn't old enough to really know what's going on around me. I was just lost, and there was even more reason for me to really not want to have anything to do with faith or prayer, even though I went to Catholic school from 5 years old on, and spent my whole childhood in Catholic school. I got raised by nuns and priests, but I really didn't want to have anything to do with prayer. It was just not the right thing for me. I didn't want to understand what faith was about, and it wasn't practiced at home either. Rather, my parents tried to kind of like heal those wounds of the separations with, I guess, a lot of material things. My stepdad was in the, and still is in the restaurant business. we made a good living. You know, my mom was working during the day as a realtor. My dad was always working at night in the restaurant. So we had everything provided for us. We always had to eat. We always had good clothing, good schools, you know, everything that we needed on a worldly basis. But just emotionally, there was a big void that I had within me, which I didn't realize. I was just very outgoing and, you know, always hanging around with my friends and always be the clown in class. You know, I thought that was just what was expected of me. I didn't really realize that deep within me it was a big sadness, because I tried to hide it, you know, put on that what we call in community so many masks, just to not let anyone know what was going on within me. And, well, through the years, that was just who I became, you know, and, like, the masks increased. I had a mask for my friends, a mask for my family, both families. One mask for my mom's side, one mask for my dad's side, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I was a different person to my girlfriend, you know. But I was still away from even thinking about using drugs. That was just not my world. I remember when I started going to culinary school at the age of 14, which I really liked, because I liked the restaurant business, the dynamic of it, being around people, you know, joking around, the languages, the working at night. I liked that. You know, my bigger brother, who is 10 years older than me, Frank, he did that as a waiter, as a bartender, and that always, you know, seemed quite cool to me, so I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And so I went to culinary school, and I was a sheltered kid. Of course, the guys that I was hanging out with changed as from childhood on. Then I spent more time on the streets, I would say, more outside, came home later. So my mom saw that, and she didn't really want me to be around, you know, the wrong crowd. And of course, I used that, since I had a lot of resentment toward my family, to upset her on purpose. So after school, I had like a 30-minute window to go, you know, smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol in a bar that was located right next to our school. I thought it was cool, and it was kind of like that, you know, that soft rebellion that kind of started against my parents.
And this, Philip, was at 14 years of age, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
When you started drinking
and smoking. I was
already smoking
a couple of years, hidden, you know, stealing cigarettes from my mom, and because we weren't old enough to buy them yet, you know. Mm-hmm. And the drinking was, you know, astounding, but like, it was very easy to get. You know, no one would ask. In Austria, is the second in the world in beer consumed in the whole wide world.
Mm-hmm.
So alcohol is everywhere. Really,
yes.
It was harder to get cigarettes than alcohol. So, and that was just what we did after school. So very early on, I was just used to drinking every day. And then, of course, wherever we worked, I was cooking or you know, waitering on several occasions, catering. And that was just, alcohol was always around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was far away from doing drugs because I was still into sports. You know, I was very active in my free time with my friends and in skating and mountain biking and all that stuff, playing soccer. But I remember, as if it was yesterday, when I was 16, you know, I finally gave in because people around me started smoking pot. It was just what you did. I was just never attracted to it because I didn't see the purpose. I didn't see anything positive coming out of it. But I remember that one day when one of my better friends asked me if I wanted a drag. So I don't know if I had a bad day or whatever. I think it was just a feeling that I didn't want to be an outsider. I just didn't want to, you know. So I did it. And, you know, nothing really happened. I was just dizzy, and, you know, the high expectations didn't really, you know, they didn't get fulfilled. But I continued doing it just because to be part of the group, there was 5-6 of us who hung out every day. So I continued doing it, and it just became a habit, just like smoking and drinking. What I did not know, though, and that's, I guess, why people call it the gateway drug. It's just, you know, this is always around you. Once I did it, there was like this barrier was broken. Just like when the first time when I got drunk, it was just like a certain boundary that I overstepped, which made it way easier to give in to other things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so from 16 to 18, in 2 years, after smoking pot the first time, came the pills, then came all the other stuff, like speed and ecstasy and all the other drugs, until finally at 18 I found myself doing what I thought I would never do, using heroin.
Mm-hmm.
I went so fast, I didn't even know how that happened. I started going out, I started partying, I started to do everything that I could do to do exactly the opposite of what my mom told me I should do. It was just, you know, I had so much resentment and I just didn't want to listen anymore. I thought I was a man because I was working, I was making money, I had finished my school, I did my military duty, you know, and then I thought I was a man, and I was far away from being one. It was just a big illusion. The problem was that, you know, once you start doing drugs, it seems all so exciting and everybody does it and it's cool, you know, and that's what you see in the movies and the bad guys always do that. And What you don't know is that, you know, how the end of it is, that once you overstep that boundary, you're caught and you're just being a slave. And I, you know, we talked about that briefly. I realized at the age of 18, and sadly enough, the guy who introduced me to heroin was my best friend when we did military together, because he thought it works for him, so he wanted to do me a favor. He offered it to me. It was for free, and in that moment I thought, wow, this is it. This is what I want to do. I understand why everybody says it's the mother of all drugs. So I did it, but I realized after a short period, after a couple of months, I woke up the first time withdrawing, having a craving for that drug, and that never happened before with any other drug. It was just something that you did when you partied and whatever, but you thought you would have it under control, you could stop it, but with heroin it was different. So I was still strong enough to get out of it and stop doing it. I called my friend and said, listen, if we hang out, every time we hang out with each other, we're doing that stuff, you know, and it's just not good. It's like it tears me up. So I stopped seeing him in order to get away from that drug. Otherwise, I knew I would be too weak. And so we didn't see each other for a year, and I really stopped doing heroin. And, like, I still did the other stuff. And in the meantime, broke up with my long-term relationship, you know, lost my whole family because I got in debt with the other drugs. I just did bad things and made a bunch of bad decisions and, you know, thought I had it all together, but I really didn't. And so, you know, with that mindset, you know, it was only a matter of time since I met again with my best friend back then. And the day we met, like within an hour, we got high again. And that was just the beginning of the end. And following that was almost 10 years of daily heroin consume. It was just very, very bad until I found myself waking up at psych ward. You know, in these years, I tried to get off. I was an outpatient, inpatient. I had about, I would say, estimate, you know, 10 psychiatrists, psychologists through the years. I did counseling, and I went as an inpatient once in an institution for a couple of months. And it all worked. I got physically sober, you know, and it was nice. And I had, like, the psychiatrist, and they listened to my problems. They had a bunch of good counsel, help for me, you know. But it didn't change my outlook on life. I had, like, this sadness within me, which I didn't know how to fill it. I had this big void. So every time I got sober, I got scared because I had nowhere to go. I had no positive outlook on my life. I just didn't know what to do with myself. I felt like I wasn't worth, you know, being in this world. So I relapsed every time. I just it was just a matter of time, and it's always so easy because so, wherever I went, whoever I met, all the people I knew were drug addicts.
Yeah.
So it was just very easy to fall back.
You'd go right back to the same location, the same friends.
Yeah,
and,
even if I locked myself up. I mean, the phone would ring, and friends were like, oh, I heard you were out. We come over, have a party, and within no time. I was just too weak because I needed to feel, you know, loved at the end, accepted, to be around people that understood what I was going through, because my family certainly didn't. They couldn't because, you know, they even though they witnessed everything that was going on through the years, I would never share with them what I was really living, how the separation affected me, what was going on in school, how I suffered with the relationships that always, you know, where I could never keep them because I could never be myself. I always thought there was so many high expectations that people had in me because they saw the potential and the disillusion, you know, the disappointment, you know, that weighed a lot on me, and I couldn't share it with no one. I did with the friends when we got high. That's what helped me to open up. They just could never help me, you know, because they were just in the same boat. They were drowning with me.
So over the course then of 10 years, Philip, you really had times where you were very, very depressed, thought about suicide, made decisions that were really very bad, and realized that maybe death was the best solution for you. Would you take us from there onward?
Well, like you said, the depression, I was treated with a lot of medication, antidepressants, and, you know, a lot of stuff that I've tried to do to get away from that depression. It was just impossible. So the thought of you know, just killing myself, I told myself, listen, if this is my life, I might as well give it back, because obviously God has forgotten about me, and I don't really, you know, pray or believe in God too much anymore because so many bad things had happened. And that was just the solution that I thought would be best. And I chose the only way that I knew how to, like, you know, make an end to it, and just to increase my drug consume every day. I didn't have the courage to cut my wrist or to do other stuff. And the only thought that kept me away, I didn't really want to hurt my mom so bad again. You know, she was the person, she is the person closest to me. But then I was so desperate that I just said, you know, so I stole a lot of money in that time from all the people, especially the close ones, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And with that money, I tried to kill myself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about, like, after I got arrested, my mom and my dad came and had me arrested because that was the only way they could help me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were right. And the doctor afterwards told me you would have made it another 10 days maybe. I was down to 110 pounds. I didn't eat in weeks anymore. I didn't drink. I couldn't walk anymore. So I was really waiting on that day to just, like, finally overdose.
Yes.
It was, you know. So I got arrested and I woke up in psych ward, and that's what saved my life.
Now, the interesting thing you said to me once upon a time, Philip, was that even though you didn't pray, you know, throughout your life there, you kind of thought God had given up on you. You did utter a prayer right before you were about to commit suicide.
I was a time, you know, like, I remember, like, very vividly, I was on my couch at home and I was very sad. So I thought, okay, like, I hurt everyone around me. I lost my girlfriend, you know, my future spouse and everything. And everyone. So I wanted to actually to call my real dad. And then I thought, no, I haven't talked to him in years. You know, our relationship wasn't the best. So I thought, I can't just show up at his place and ask him for help. He's a broken man, too. He gave up after the divorce. So the only thing left to do for me was to pray. So
mm-hmm.
I was there, and I started praying to God. And, like, while I did, it was like, what am I doing here? God is definitely not going to listen to my prayers. I'm not worth it. So I just stopped praying because, like, I felt guilty with all the things that I've done. I didn't know by then that he came exactly for people like me to save us.
Yes.
You know, that it's not the righteous who need, you know, the Lord. It's the ones that are broken. I didn't know it back then. So I just stopped praying. I cried, and that was it. That was it.
Yeah, so the police arrive at your door
mm-hmm.
with your mother and your father.
Oh, yeah.
And off you go to the psych ward. You get mm-hmm. Then your mother came to you, and what did she say? This was kind of the turning point, but at the moment you didn't understand. What did she say to you?
See, she showed up one day, and she's like, okay, so what are we going to do? I said, what do you mean? We tried everything, psychiatrist, psychologist, inpatient, outpatient, 7 years of rehab. I don't know what to do anymore. She's like, well, we better fight something because it's too bad. I'm your mom. I'm not going to give up on you. You have no choice other than making it. So
mm-hmm.
she came one day. You know, I was in psych for over 2 months. And one day she showed up with a little flyer of a colorful flyer. And there was a word on it I couldn't read. And she said, yeah, this is the Tenazzolo. You know, she said she didn't speak any Italian. She didn't even know how to pronounce it. I don't know how she got that flyer. She's like, yeah, there is this place. I don't know the people. I don't know what they do, you know, but maybe we could try it. And I said, if you don't know what they're doing, why would we consider it?
Yeah.
And she looked me in the eye. She's like, well, you know, they pray. So I couldn't help myself. I had to laugh. I was like,
mm-hmm.
oh, really? Look around you. I'm locked up. There's bars on the windows. They wouldn't let me go in the bathroom by myself. You think I would give it a try? And for sure, that's going to save my life. And sure enough, it did because we went there. We went there to meet the Chinacolo guys on a Saturday. That was the only time I got permission to leave the facility for a couple of hours. So I went there with my mom, and I sat there, and I looked at the guys. They had tattoos all over. You could still see the scars in their underarms from where they were shooting heroin. But, you know, you looked in their faces, and like you said a little before, you meet those people, and you said, there's no way that these are drug addicts.
Isn't it the truth? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're smiling from their eyes.
Yeah, so it's like they have halos on with their
right?
tattoos and their scars and their stories. And, yeah, it's such a change. I'm going to just redirect here and let people know who I'm talking with. This is the Family Sanctuary, St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. My guest is Philip Szabo. He is talking with us now about his life of drug addiction and how the community Chinacolo is what really saved his life, turned him around, and made him realize that his life is valuable, God loves him, and God is the answer. So, Philip, take us then after you entered Chinacolo and what it really did for you.
That was a rough ride, I tell you that. At the end, I got there to Chinacolo, honestly, just to make my mom happy. I said, I'm going to give this place a chance for like a week or so, you know, and then I'll figure something out. Because even though I had no place to go and nothing to do, I didn't really know what to do. But I was not, you know, really ready to face, you know, a brand new chapter in my life. I thought I would have to do it alone. But then I got there, and within a couple of days, I was like, okay, this might actually work. I looked around, and I saw all those people. They did the same stuff as me. They were just struggling just as me, but the difference was they were smiling. They were happy. They were facing the challenge. And, you know, you would do it together. You would not have to do it by yourself. That's what I was always scared about because I knew I didn't have the strength to do it. So I entered in Austria in a house that is about 30 minutes south from where I live. Never heard about it. None of the doctors where I was, they never heard about it. And, like, it was really unknown. Some of the people had known Medjugorje from had known the Cenacolo from Medjugorje, but they didn't even know there was one in Austria. So as I entered there, I found out pretty fast that this might work. If there's one thing, actually, then this would be it. So even though I wasn't sure I want to stay, I gave it a shot. And the responsible there saw pretty fast that, you know, I was the kind of guy, you know, been there, done that, you know, the arrogant attitude that I had. And, you know, I made so much money. I know so many people have been there and done that and all those jobs. So they transferred me pretty fast to South Italy, 2,000 kilometers away from home.
We should say, should we jump in here and just let our listeners know how many Cenacolo communities are there throughout the world? This is an international community.
Right.
How many houses?
62 in the whole world.
62 in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And there are how many in the United States?
We have two for the men, one for the women down in St. Augustine, and one up here in beautiful Alabama, and close, right next to the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament. So there's four houses.
Four houses.
And we're working on some more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, four houses in the United States. And so go on. Let's tell us about what life is like in Cenacolo then.
Oh, it's a beautiful life. You know, you don't realize it at first, but you live in community. Like when the youth come to us and, you know, we explain to them what it is, we say, okay, here's what we don't have. We don't have radio, no television, no newspaper, no MTV, no girls, no smoking, no drinking, no cell phones. You see their face, you know, they turn pale.
It's like who
how
wants
do you
to
even live without
way?
All that?
Yeah.
Like, happily. We have a community, have the opportunity to find back to who we really are. What we do is we pray a lot and we work a lot. We don't have, like, the luxurious life that we all used to in the world. We get up early in the morning at 6. We pray the rosary in the chapel all together. We eat together. We work together. Everyone has a responsibility, since the living in community is kind of like on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
It's always the same kind of concept. It's just us. There is no boss. There is no psychologist. There is no doctors. There mm-hmm. is no priest. So it's just us. What we have is each other. We have, between, there's houses that have 10, 12 guys. There's houses where there's 70, 80. There's houses where there's whole families present. So whatever you need to do to maintain the house, it goes from house cleaning, from cooking to dealing with the animals. We have pigs and rabbits and cows. In most houses, we have a huge vegetable garden. We're pretty much self-sustaining with the food. We bake our own bread. We make our own pizza. You know, we eat together always. You're never alone in the community. So you pretty much work all day. You know, we have mm-hmm. sports. We play soccer together. We go running together. We have mass, confession, adoration, everything that a healthy life should have.
You have beautiful chapels in these houses, too, which I think is, Jesus is always present.
He is always present. We have the blessing of, you know, the big blessing of having the Holy Eucharist, the Blessed Sacrament, with us. So you can go, that's one of the benefits in community, when people say, well, you don't have radio and television and MTV. I said, yeah, but you don't have a chapel at home. You know, we do.
Yeah.
So you can just, whenever you feel like it, go into the chapel and talk to Jesus. And that's the biggest blessing ever. And that's why it works, Mary. And that's why it works. Not because we are so capable of doing or we have so much money. It's not. Because the chapel, Madre Vida taught us, is the first room that we built in every house that we're building. Because this is where it starts and this is where it ends. Because of the presence of Jesus, the living presence of Jesus in our house, that's why it works. Otherwise, it would just be a house of 20 ex-drug addicts. You can imagine how that would turn out.
And probably not so well, because, you know, as you say, people come in with their attitudes that, hey, mm-hmm. I've been here, I've done it. I'm a worldly guy. I had all of this money. I had all of this wonderful life. And it's not until rock bottom, you lose it all, you've got nothing, but then you find the Cenacolo community and you've got Jesus. You really, in the community, rely on divine providence too. There's no, it's not like you're working and making money while you're there. It's the wonderful people that are on the outside that support. And you oftentimes don't know where your next meal is coming from, particularly maybe in the winter when the fields aren't all, you know, producing. And what if the chickens aren't giving the eggs that day or whatever that you have? You're not real sure always where that next meal is coming from, but it always comes, doesn't it,
exactly,
Philip?
In the almost 34 years of our existence, no one ever starved. No one ever did not have a place to lay his head. And this is what teaches you at the end, what taught me, that, you know, I'm not in charge. You
yes.
know, if I need something, I'll just pray for it. It might not always be, you know, what I want, but it's definitely good God always lets me have what I need. And there's so many stories of, like, you know, we can produce a lot ourselves, like vegetables and all that, but we can't make coffee, so we pray for coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't have any, then we got coffee. Maybe we don't have sugar, so we start praying for sugar. And then the day when you have both, wow. I mean, it seems such a small thing, but then you have coffee with sugar. You didn't do anything for it but pray. So people see what we do, you know. And through our prayers, we always, like St. Joseph always provides for us. We would always have exactly what we need. And it's good to see that divine providence always works. And it's good to see how little you really need to be happy. So the people, when they come and visit us, they see all around the world, they see what is happening here. Like you said before, they come to our house and say, oh, no, where are the drug addicts? You wouldn't believe that these guys not too long ago were on the streets, were homeless, were prostitutes, were heroin addicts, whatever.
Yeah.
You know. And now, like, you strip everything away and bring them to Jesus, and they're the happiest people in the world. So that's why people donate.
And that's why I love it, and I'm so happy to be able to come and visit. I will be back down there next week to see you all. Well,
right.
You're not at the community anymore, but you do a lot. You're living outside the community now, but you're very much a part of it in all ways. So I'll certainly see you. Philip, before we cut out here, I want you to give the website so that our listeners can check it out online and learn more.
Definitely. That will be www.hopereborn.org. Hopereborn.org.
HOPEREBORN.org. Thanks so much, Philip. It's been just such a great pleasure to have you with me today. And thank you to our listeners. Tune in on Mondays at 12:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. for more editions of The Family Sanctuary. Until next time, God bless.
Family Sanctuary is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Family Sanctuary with Marianne Jepson and Peggy Hartshorn are available at stgabrielradio.com.